Okay, welcome everyone. We are live. So welcome to another Capital Tech LinkedIn Live. And today we have two of the authors of the book Commencement, Kate Colbert and Joe Sausalito. I'll turn the floor over to you. Why don't you guys kind of give a overview of yourselves and the book?
Well, I'll go first, and you got to redo my last name. It's Sallustio. You got to say it with like a little panache. Sallustio.
That's right. I got you.
So thanks for having us, Brad. It's been, gosh, we've known each other for a couple of years now. And it's funny that you say that we're two of the authors of the book, because there are 125 others that informed this book, of which you are one of those. And you're highlighted so many times in this book, and we appreciate all your contributions. Again, my name is Joe Sallustio. I'm a 20-year veteran of higher ed. You could call me an insider and an outsider simultaneously. I'm also the founder, co-founder of the EdUp Experience podcast, along with my compadre, Elvin Freites, of which you also were on that, Dr. Sim. So you know what? It all comes full circle. Kate, over to you.
Well, I know everybody because Joe knows everybody. So I came late to the party a couple years after EdUp was first founded. Joe reached out to me and we started working on this project together. So I'm Kate Colbert and I'm a higher education outsider. Used to be an insider running marketing departments at graduate schools, and have been doing a lot of market research and brand work and consulting for colleges and universities across the nation. And then recently teamed up with Joe Sallustio to write Commencement, the Beginning of a New Era in Higher Education.
Excellent. So if you are listening online, please go ahead and you can type in your questions and or your comments, and we can look at those as we go along. But we'll spend the next 30 minutes highlighting some of the good stuff that's in the book. Of course, there is one quote that's my favorite in the book. Future of higher education requires being flexible and being entrepreneurial. So but it's my favorite quote because it's
because you said it.
That's right.
You said it.
So kind of highlight for the folks listening, you know, what the gems you glean as you go through this book. It's got, as you mentioned, Joe, hundreds of authors really from all the EdUp podcasts that you've done. And so it must have been hard anyway to discern all that information down into just what book you have today.
Yeah, you know, that's why I had to have Kate with me, because it was a impossible one person job. I mean, you're talking about some of the most insightful, relevant, important, and impactful conversations in the entirety of higher education that have happened on the EdUp Experience podcast. And you take all of those and you try to say, hey, how do we take 125 presidents that we've interviewed and take all this knowledge and stick it? You know, who's going to, it, could any one person go back and take the same away from 125 episodes? How do we pull out those highlights? And to be quite honest with you, I was less objective. Because I've heard it, I'll go, oh, this one was this. Oh, that one was that. And you start to lose lose some of the overarching themes because you get into it. And Kate was that person that kind of pulled 30,000 foot and said, okay, here's the overarching themes. Here's who hit these. Here's who hit those. So it was a really important partnership to get us through that, right? Because it was hard to get through, don't you think, Kate?
Yeah, it was the biggest, hardest project of my career, really going through. In fact, I was just this morning interviewed for our local NPR affiliate, and they were asking, how in the world did you take all these awesome quotes from presidents and figure out how to put them together in a way that just doesn't feel like a book full of disconnected quotes? And that was really hard work. And it was many phases. It was actually a fairly sort of scientific, technical approach at first, going through all of the transcripts from the 125 interviews with college and university presidents, as well as interviews with two top ed tech leaders, and figuring out what's being said. You know, Joe and I really actually didn't have an agenda going into this book. We have our own opinions about the future of higher education and we share them in the book, but we wanted to know, what are the people who are leading colleges and universities today saying about what the opportunities are, where the pain points are, sort of what's that mix of treasures and troubles that are happening in post-secondary education, and what does the future look like? And so we listened to what you all said and then figured out, where are the big themes in that? And then how do we take all these brilliant quotes and edit them and clean them up and then figure out, how does this all come together? What are the two big themes? What are the two sections of the book? And then how do we break these into chapters? And we literally hand coded things and color coded and figured out this idea leads to this idea. And this president says something that builds upon this president, or this president says something that flips what this president said completely on its head. And it's a really good argument back and forth. And how do we then stitch that all together with a narrative that tells my stories and Joe's stories and then brings Elvin in as well? So it really is a book with about 250 voices when you think about the fact that we also did survey research as well and included all the data from that research. So we wanted this to be a really interesting book and not just a book full of disconnected quotes. I think we nailed it. I'm really proud of it. I think that it reads really, really comfortably and easily and fun. Really proud of it. But yeah, it was a heck of a project.
No, it does read pretty easy. It's enjoyable. And it's not the standard book that you can buy that talks about what's going on in higher ed. You know, there's a lot of books out there. I thought years ago, you know, since I had worked in industry first and then I got into higher education, so I kind of have a different perspective of what higher education may be versus the traditional academics. But it made me think that, you know, I could write a book called something like Behind the Ivory Towers and really explain how it works, right? Because you know, it's a career. Folks come into higher education for many different reasons, just like you go to work for the private sector or government. And as you're going through your daily tasks at the job, you have to work within the system that is higher education. And I worked at state universities and I worked at private nonprofits, which I'm at now. And there's differences between those. There's some similarities. So I know it kind of influences what's going on in higher education the way that it is, but my focus has always been on building careers. And so, I mean, I was one of those folks who went to school to get a job and went in a technical area and really enjoyed my time. And I was working in the construction industry for several years before I went back to school. But what's your thoughts on where do you think the universities really are going after we've, you know, I saw some changes after the recession of 08, and now there's changes after COVID era. So what do you think is going to happen in higher education from everybody that you've talked to moving into the next 5-10 years?
Well, isn't that that's like the red pill, blue pill question. I get to ask people that all the time on the podcast, and that really informed the book, right? We'd ask people, including yourself, Brad, what do you see as the future of higher education? The interesting part about this book and one of the most interesting parts of that question is that it really depends on who you ask. And, you know, there's a, Kate said this a long time ago as we were talking about chapters, she said the book was a love letter and a devil's advocate. We could have somebody that we're profiling in one section that says higher ed has value and degree, double down on your degrees. And then we can have somebody in the next section who dismantles that entirely and says the degrees don't have value. And so I think the answer lies probably somewhere in the middle. To your point, it's about business, it's about industry, it's about pathways. How you get there and when you get there will be different for each person. You know, and what does the lifelong learning pipeline look like? One of the things that makes no sense for higher education, and you know this, Dr. Sims, you're doing this at CTU. How do you keep your students coming back when they need more education? You know, there's less brand loyalty in higher education than there is in almost every other industry. When you think about online shopping, where do you go? You probably go one particular place. When you think about staying in a hotel, what do you choose? I know what I choose, and I choose the same hotel chain all the time because I stay in hotels a lot. When I think about buying a car, I typically think about one or two brands that I'm buying. In higher ed, there isn't that same level of brand loyalty. So I think it's gonna, the future of higher ed, a big part of it is speed to service, right? Students are expecting a faster level of service. And how do you develop for an institution? How do we develop brand loyalty and do it in a way where the student sees a continual value in return? Because if there aren't as many students, how do you get the ones that are available to come back to you when they need something? That's my take on it.
Yeah, I think Joe hits on a lot of the really big things that are changing in higher education right now. And I think one of the things we really heard the presidents talking about, and then we're seeing sort of playing out, is we're looking at sort of a death of elitism in higher education, which I think is a really good thing, that folks are less interested in where they sit on some arbitrary ranking list and are less interested in having a campus with Ivy covered everything, but actually delivering real access to all the students who want to come learn there, creating real opportunity for them, going beyond just diversity, but creating belongingness for students, which is so critical, especially for younger students, but also for older students, and really, really opening up the door to all the learners who want to learn, right? So you're talking about, how do you upskill, reskill? How do you get people back after they've come and done some sort of education with you? How do you get them back 5 years later, 10 years later, 15 years later? I think higher education has always talked a good game about it, to Joe's point, about lifelong learning, but have not delivered on it. And so we've got 39 million Americans in the United States right now who have some college and no degree, who might be looking for some sort of experience, whether it's short-term or long-term, whether it's competency-based or sort of more traditional look. What does it look like for colleges and universities to be able to say to all the different segments of learners who are interested in doing something new and learning something new, to say, you fit here, you're welcome here? And that is not to say that I think colleges and universities should become all things to all people. I think truly comprehensive universities struggle, right? If you look at big universities right now, and they're taking a look at the number of students raising their hand and majoring in things like English and history and other humanities, is dropping 40, 50, 60%. And then you're stuck with all these tenured faculty with not enough students to teach those classes. But what I think the future really looks like is institutions actually like yours, saying, this is the niche. This is where we want to be expert, right? You want to work for the Department of Defense. You want to work in these particular fields, NASA, NSA, et cetera. You're going to go to Capital Technology University, and you're not trying to win, the folks who want to be social workers, right? And what does that look like if colleges and universities can be really clear about what makes them unique and different and meaningfully different, and be unapologetic about it, and recruit those students who they can really, really help? And I think that the adult student population is a huge part of that right now. I'm watching every single day on LinkedIn. We're seeing another school closing its doors or announcing that it's closing its doors. And they are invariably institutions that refuse to serve anyone except 18 to 23 year olds who are looking for an on-campus, brick and mortar, coming of age, traditional bachelor's degree experience. And that's just a tiny segment of the people who want to learn in the United States.
Yes. And some of the systems, the way they were designed, are certainly operationally heavy in cost. And so whenever you approach universities that aren't thinking more like a business mindset in the way they operate, those costs are heavy. And it's hard to start cutting those costs when the markets change, and as quickly as the market change is kind of way I look at it. And, if, let's say, you're XYZ University and you built up tons of buildings on campus and you have tons of personnel, and all of a sudden your students decline in enrollment, you're really in a hard place because you have all those fixed costs, right? And so I think that online is certainly an element that's not going to go away. I first experienced online back in 2000 and roughly five. I created an online master's degree because I thought, let's try it out. Let's see what the market's like. And it's one of the most successful master's online degrees at Western Carolina, where I used to work today. So it was a learning experience for me, but I did try it out because I wanted to ensure I built the program around a quality education and not just putting up text to read or something like that. But I think you see today all the tools that you have out there, we use LMS in Canvas or Zoom as our synchronous thing. I think eventually higher education will be a mix of everything. There's going to be a blend of the classroom that you don't go sit in the classroom, and it's not just completely faceless, synchronous listening to somebody or reading text. It's going to be really quite different. And then, of course, with virtual reality, once that really becomes easy, accessible for everybody, it's just going to change the dynamic, because education will be available anywhere, and you can access it, wherever you are in the world, and the cost will be maybe not as expensive as it becomes more and more easy access to that technology.
I love that you brought up virtual reality, because I was just in some focus groups a couple of weeks ago with a bunch of high school students who are sort of high ACT, SAT score kind of kids, and their parents. And we were talking to them about the college search process. And we asked, in terms of how colleges market to you and try to recruit you, sort of what works, what makes you roll your eyes, what's really cool. And one of the things that came up from a couple of different students that we talked to were that a couple of schools have offered a virtual reality headset experiences, where you put on your own Oculus at home and you get to tour the campus and ask questions, and it feels like you're actually there, and it's real time customized. And they said, if a school does that for me, one, I feel like I understand it well enough to consider applying there even without getting on an airplane to go for a visit. And two, if it's a brick and mortar institution, and two, they said, if I'm looking at majoring in a STEM field, and one institution is doing like really old sort of analog admission stuff, but the other one's doing virtual reality tours, which one do you think I think has a better handle on STEM? And so that was really interesting, that though, that kind of a decision about how, what you're offering at the admissions level is making a huge, huge difference. So that was kind of interesting for us to hear.
Yeah, what I would add, Brad, to your comments, by the way, I take my virtual background off for anybody that uses it. It was making my hair look way too gray. I can't look my grayness. It was actually washing out my whole, all my hairs. Super great these days, right? Because as educators, we get gray hairs by helping students. But I mean, there's no sacred cows anymore in higher ed, to your point, right? You can't change a business model if parts of your expense structure are so protected that you're unwilling to touch them. And so if you're growing by ratio, which is one way to do it, right? For every X amount of students I bring in, I'm going to hire a faculty member. Here's how many students we have in the classroom. Here's how much we're going to spend to do it. And you manage by those ratios, you can grow effectively. But if you're adding to add, or you're adding because you think you need to offer something because it's going to help your academic portfolio, that may not be the way to get there, because it's hard to dismantle those fixed costs, because your biggest fixed costs is people, and you have salaries, and you can't just go and riff everybody every time you oversaturate your expense structure. You have to be very careful and intentional about expansion. But I think this book too, what I wanted to do is, Kate wrote kind of the main narrative, was coming from the side and say, here's what everybody always has wanted to say and nobody has said, not in a way that's going to get out there to the level. We have college presidents that we've interviewed that are saying these things. Now, although the college president is more visible than they've ever been before, who fights on behalf of us to say what needs to be said? And Brad, of course, I don't include you in anything I'm saying here today, because you're one of 100 or more. But when that recording stops and that college president says, gosh, if I have to see one more committee stall an innovative idea within my institution, I'm going to scream. Now, that president's not going to say that out on a microphone that's going to go out to their faculty and staff, because maybe they don't feel like they can. But I can't tell you how many times I hear that. Death by committee is a real thing in our institutions. Why do we allow it to happen? Why do we shun hiring people from for-profit education or businesses that were for-profit and technology and bring them into higher ed and go, oh, they don't understand anything? Well, they understand business. And what we have is a failing business model. So maybe we should, stop turning our noses down at these folks who can help our institutions. Don't just put students in courses to keep a course, because it's going to further your. So there's so many things that I think needed to be said, like that just needed to be said. And that's what we hoped we did in this book. Some of them, without saying who said them, we wrote it in the narrative, and Kate wrote it in the narrative. And those aren't the things we quoted, but I guarantee you, one of the presidents we interviewed said those things many times. So that was an important part of the book, is how do we say what needs to be said?
Sure.
And they said things, you know, they did say, and some of them did go on record with things like talking about that, you know, your institution is only as good as your board of trustees. So those were really interesting, because we think about how many times somebody is named to a board because their family gave a lot of money to that institution, or because their name or their title or their affiliation sounds really impressive. But are they somebody who's really passionate about higher education or about the industries that the particular university needs to be educating the workforce for? So are we being thoughtful about who we put on our boards, who we put on our advisory boards, how we use them? And those are some of the places that institutions have gotten just sort of stuck in weird habits or sort of old ways of doing things. And that's one of the things that we were excited about in this book, is that so many of the people we talked to are willing to sort of blow up old models and say, like, why would we used to do it that way? That doesn't work. And the committee thing, you know, for sure is like, it's huge. And the pandemic was, you know, we argue in the book that the pandemic in many ways was a panacea for a lot of higher education's issues, because it forced higher education leaders to make decisions on behalf of the students and on behalf of their own workforce very, very quickly, and to trust their gut and to do the right thing without getting stalled in committees and without having to go to the board and without, you know, doing some sort of, you know, study about whether or not this is going to work. And we got, you know, to your point, Brad, and you talked, there's a reason, you know, we put that quote about entrepreneurism in the way we lead and think. And we gave you a full page for that quote in our book, because it's important. The institutions that are responding to the needs of today's learners are the ones that are led by people who have an entrepreneurial mindset and who are comfortable with ambiguity, and who are willing to take some risks and say, hey, here's what we think our customers, our students, our as well as our faculty and our staff and our donors and our community partners, here's what we think they need from us. And we want to try out giving them something different and see how it goes. And I think in many ways, higher education was overbuilt in the United States. Like, you know, one of my graduate degrees is from Illinois State University, which is actually at the end of the exact same street as Illinois Wesleyan University, right? So we have towns that have multiple universities and a community college. And I'm not sure the United States ever needed 4,000 colleges and universities. And as things are going, we won't have that many going forward. What we need is institutions that provide access and affordability and results, outcomes, learning outcomes that really get people where they want to go in their lives and their jobs. We don't need thousands and thousands of institutions to do that. We just need the right number of them to be doing it well.
Yeah, I agree, you know, and we at Capital Tech, of course, we're focused around industry needs. And so our degree programming, since it's all STEM, is just based around STEM degrees for the companies that we work with on a regular basis, whether it's a private company or a government agency or whatnot. And when we add degrees, you know, we're working in association with where the market is, so that we can ensure if you're an undergraduate, you're going to get a great career. If you're a master's or doc student, we created those for full-time working individuals in industry who want to advance their careers. And that's our market. And so we're not going to expand into, you know, hundreds of different programs that are outside of STEM. We may not be the largest enrollment because of that, but we're very comfortable in the fact that we want to provide you a great career or advance your career. And in our undergraduate population, we even guarantee all of our on-campus students that if they don't make a minimum of $50,000 upon graduation, that we'll pay their and their parents' student quarterly loan payments till they exceed it. And we guarantee them if they don't have a career in 90 days in their career field, they can come back free for a certificate in another area. And we can provide that because we have more jobs than we have students, you know. So we certainly welcome more students because the job market's there. But that's our flavor, right? And so everybody has a different flavor at their university and their expertise. It's going to be interesting, I think, as Kate, you mentioned earlier, there's been a slew of schools that either had to close or merge over the last several years. And I don't think that's trending down anywhere. And so how do they, you know, what do they need to do? And they need to do it in a timely fashion to be ahead of the curve, because, you know, those finances will come back quickly to the point where you just can't get out of the hole.
Agreed. And I think that as we kind of come up on our time here, I just want everybody to know about the book. We really wrote this for you, and it's written by you. And when I say you, I'm not just talking about the 125 college presidents. I'm talking about everybody Kate and I has ever interacted with on the podcast, in our professional careers, at every level, to say, you know, to use this book almost like a workbook. You know, yeah, does it deserve to be on your library shelf and in your higher education programs? Absolutely, because there's no book that's informed by better research than 125 presidents. But also, you know, to be able to use it and say, somebody else is doing this, why we can innovate too. And that's what we hope you take away from it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've been hearing from readers, and we've been really fortunate that since the book release that we've talked to so many people, and folks are taking pictures. I literally, as we were logging into this, I saw somebody had posted a photograph of the book with quoting somebody, you know, with a picture of somebody's quote, and didn't mention the title of the book or me and Joe. And somebody else who's read the book chimed in and says, looks like you're reading Commencement by Joe Sluzio and Kate Colbert, which is really great. But one of the things we're learning is that folks, whether you work in the admissions office or you're chief academic officer, or, you know, you oversee residence life or whatever it is you do, you're a faculty member and the social sciences, folks are telling us that they're reading this book. And to Joe's point about the things nobody's ever been willing to say out loud, they're saying, oh, thank goodness, like somebody's finally saying these things. And there's so many practical tips for how to think about the work that you do and how you work with students and how you work with faculty. And they're saying, oh my gosh, there's finally a book for me. You know, if I'm an assistant director of marketing at a community college, this book talks about my career. This book talks directly to me. And that's been really exciting for us to hear people say, like, oh my gosh, for the first time in my career, I've picked up a book that is really written for the careers of people who work in on behalf of and around higher education. I don't think there's another book like Commencement in the marketplace. And that's why we wrote it, because we knew that you all deserved it. And we knew that we are, you know, 2 feet in to this new era in higher education. And it's not just post-pandemic. You know, I love what you were just talking about, Brad, about the guarantee that you offer to your graduates. That's the future. That's the future, right? Like, nobody wants to buy a pair of jeans online without knowing they can return them if they don't fit. For a much higher involvement sale, for, you know, giving multiple years or months of your life and a lot of money and a lot of hard work and energy to earn some sort of academic credential, nobody wants to find out that it was a waste of their time and money and it's not going to serve them in their life or their career. And so to do what you're doing at Capital Tech and schools like Foundry College, who says you don't have to pay the tuition until you get out there with a family supporting wage and we guarantee that you will, you guys are at the forefront of where higher education is headed. And man, oh man, am I personally really honored to have a seat as part of these conversations.
Excellent. Is there a website for the book? I didn't look for the website.
Yeah, absolutely. So www.commencementthebook.com is a great place to learn more about the book. You can buy it really anywhere books are sold. Look at that beautiful book. I know I've got a million versions that have post-its all over them for all the media interviews. Commencementthebook.com, or you can go check it out on Amazon. And then folks, we are seeing lots of colleges and universities that want 25 copies, 100 copies, 300 copies for their faculty and staff to be reading. If you go to commencementthebook.com, there's actually a place to place your order for bulk order and get discounts on those.
Can you get it on Kindle?
Of course. Yes. Absolutely. In fact, that's really fun. Every day we get to see our stats on how many pages were read on Kindle. But I'll tell you this, folks are telling us that most people who buy it on Kindle are finding that they really want to be able to scribble in the margins and make notes. And so I've lost track of how many people said they bought the Kindle version, started reading it, and decided to buy the paperback as well. Oh, hey, we just got a question come in. Alice Martinez, one of the things I loved was the message of being student-centered. That was our heart. You know, Joe and I really, really, really care about students. And we loved that so many of the presidents talked about student-centric cultures. And so we wrote an entire chapter called The People Imperative. And it was really all about serving students where they are, sort of meeting them where they are and giving them what they need and hearing them and adjusting the way that we deliver higher education exactly for the students. So Dr. Martinez, I'm glad to hear that that resonated for you.
I agree. I mean, 100%. So when I left the private sector and accidentally got in higher education and then started teaching, I've been at several state universities and two private nonprofits. The thing that I always remember that really makes it worthwhile to me all these years that I've been in higher education is the fact that whatever position you have, whether you're directly in the classroom or you're in administration or whatever participative, you are directly somehow affecting somebody's life. And the way that you can enhance it by providing them a quality degree where they can go out and earn a living for themselves and their family, whether they're 18 years old going into school, transitioning military, adult career learner, that to me is the thing that I prize most, is that somehow I have been involved with thousands of students that are out there and they didn't even know I was participating in their education, but they are successful individuals. So that is well worth the years of working in higher education and not being in the private sector, which I enjoyed as well.
Yeah, that's a good reminder that everyone, no matter whether the students know you or not personally, that you're really touching them. And we talk about, Joe actually tackles some of these issues really head on in the book in terms of policies. So we talk about things like leave of absence policies, right? A student gets sick or some sort of life happens for a student. If we don't have a policy to say, hey, we know life got in the way, go handle what you need to do. Can we keep in touch with you while you're gone? And can we talk about how to make life easier for you to get you back? A lot of institutions are just letting those students disappear on them instead of helping them succeed. And so we talk a lot about everything from leave of absence policies to, you know, is the financial aid office open, you know, on the evenings or weekends when adult students are logging in and are available and have questions or have needs? And so that idea of really sort of great wraparound services was an important part of this book.
Excellent. So we're almost out of time. So I just have one last question is, when are you recording the audio version?
We get asked that all the time. Nobody wants to. So it's a long book. It's 558 pages. It takes about 18 hours to read. Nobody wants to listen to me talk for 18 hours. Wow. Right. It does work as a workbook. So we do think people enjoy writing it. And that's what we're hearing. But I do love the idea of people listening to some of it. So we are currently working with an audiobook publisher that may be interested in acquiring the rights to the audiobook version. So it's a little bit down the road, probably. It's a long book, and it's going to take a couple of voices to get recorded, so actors to hire and all that good stuff. So yes, we're thinking about it. But if you're wanting to read the book right now, don't wait for the audiobook, because it could be another year or so. Go get your paperback or your Kindle edition.
Excellent book. I want to thank you, Kate and Joe, for being with me today. And everybody should go out and certainly get a copy of the book Commencement. It's on Amazon, so you can get it in a quick fashion. And once again, thank you guys. And I appreciate everybody who's listened to our live LinkedIn today.
Thanks, Dr. Sims.
Bye.
See you.